TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Daniel Ellsberg, The Doomsday Machine. Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. This is an archival program by TUC Radio. The international journalist Robert Fisk wrote just a week ago in the British Independent of August 2019 that we should have paid more attention to the anniversaries of Hiroshima and Nagasaki this year, since India, Pakistan, Israel, Iran, and the U.S. are currently, quote, rattling the nuclear cage. And Donald Trump has just pulled the U.S. out of the Cold War Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia. When this program was broadcast first in early 2018, Donald Trump's serial threats of destruction on North Korea had also heightened the risk of nuclear war. And the Seattle anti-nuclear movement invited Daniel Ellsberg for an on-stage discussion about nuclear winter, staggering death tolls, and how terrifyingly easy it is to set off such a war. Ellsberg had just been able to publish his most recent book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. He had been unable to find a publisher. In 1961, Ellsberg consulted for the Department of Defense and the White House and drafted Secretary Robert McNamara's plans for nuclear war. Ellsberg discovered then that the authority to initiate use of nuclear weapons had been widely delegated. If the secret plans for general nuclear war under Eisenhower had been executed, Ellsberg wrote, they would have caused the near extinction of humanity. Ellsberg now says that U.S. nuclear strategy has not fundamentally changed since the eras of late Eisenhower and early Kennedy. Ellsberg says that the legacy of this most dangerous arms buildup in the history of civilization and its proposed renewal under the Trump administration threatens our survival. This conversation begins with a discussion of nuclear winter. Here is Daniel Ellsberg.
Our plans that we're now considering under H.R. McMaster, the Special Security Advisor, is, quote, to give the North Koreans a bloody nose. We really do want them to give up their nuclear weapons, and to show it, we hit their missile sites, we hit command and control, we do something else. The chance of that actually ending hostilities is as close to zero as anything could be. Both sides, in other words, are under the crazy impression that it's better for them to go first than second. And if they're convinced that war is coming, or in Trump's case, that it's the only way of getting rid of their nuclear weapons, he might do it. And actually, he's not wrong about this. There is no other way, no other military solution. Let me quote one of my favorite authorities, Stephen Bannon, who has been saying throughout, before he was fired, there is no military solution in Korea, one of the reasons he was fired. Well, when he's right, he's right. It's possible to be both crazy and smart in the same head, and in fact, it happens all the time. Trump, on the other hand, if he really believes that he can, or H.R. McMaster, he can give the North Koreans a bloody nose and it will stop there, it's crazy. The theme of my book was expressed in an earlier form of the title, A Chronicle of Madness, that the nuclear epoch has been one in which very widely leaderships in both sides have believed, have held crazy beliefs as to what was possible, what was necessary, and what was justified. And they've been allowed to do that to a large extent, just as Republicans, let's say, will go along now with the idea that there is no man-made climate change. So they're able to live through what's happening in New York right now and in Boston and say, no climate change. Well, likewise, our military planning for nuclear war has been based on the idea, sort of, well, if we have to carry this out, here's how we'll do it. You know, and it's different ways of planning near extinction of the human species. 1983 was perhaps the most dangerous part, comparable to the Cuban Missile Crisis 20 years earlier. And we didn't even know that, and the reason was that the then Soviet leader, former KGB head, Andropov, had become convinced that the US, Reagan, was planning a first strike against the Soviet Union. Now, Reagan was not. That was absolutely wrong. But what could have given that clue, that idea? How could such an... Reagan himself was astonished when he was finally convinced by a defector that Andropov really had feared that. And that his reaction, his actions in part were in response to that fear. How could he have imagined that? Well, Reagan was conducting the largest, fastest buildup of nuclear arms since John F. Kennedy. We're now involved in the third such buildup now. But Reagan's was the $1 trillion buildup like that. Second, Reagan, to put the Soviets off guard, was doing exercises off the Soviet coast and sending reconnaissance planes even into Soviet airspace, testing their defenses as if preparing for an invasion. This was very secret. Almost nobody in the government knew that he was doing that when they saw Russian reactions, such as the shoot down of KAL-007, the Korean airliner. Hardly anybody realized that that followed actions of penetration that had been happening, and that they confused that with a military reconnaissance plane at that time. Third, we had a president who regarded the Soviet Union as an evil empire, as he said openly, and one that should be eliminated, essentially. He even joked at a microphone on one occasion, which he didn't realize was an open microphone, and he was just testing beforehand, and he said, the Soviet Union has been banned, the bombing will begin in 15 minutes. Reagan was batting down the idea of a nuclear weapons freeze, of the kind of freeze word that's come out recently in connection with North Korea, stopping exercises on our part, stopping testing on their part. Well, the idea of a bilateral nuclear weapons freeze, with no more nuclear weapons, which I was a big part of, had to be batted down by Reagan very, very hard. He was putting first strike weapons like Pershing II into East Germany with an ability to hit Moscow within minutes. And finally, this just came out within the last year, almost 30 years later, that they had gotten from a defector, from a spy, a very super secret, higher than top secret, plan in NATO for the decapitation of Soviet command and control. Did you know this, or have you followed this? Which scared the hell out of them. As I say, this only became available in the last year, that they had this plan for cyber warfare, basically, and for hitting various command and control points, which looked exactly like a first strike plan that we might think might work. So here we had gotten Andropov into thinking that we were preparing to use an exercise, which was a nuclear weapons exercise in Europe called Able Archer, would be the cover for an actual surprise attack. And he had a huge intelligence thing going on. To this point, A, it's exactly like the present, both with respect to Russia and North Korea. And B, one little factor in here, Andropov, the KGB former chairman, and now the prime minister, the president, believed that Reagan was crazy. And he wasn't the only one who thought that, actually, to remind people at the time. And just a little footnote right now, it's in the news this week, more that Reagan was showing evidence of Alzheimer's in the White House, and which, of course, later became very evident. But he regarded him as crazy. We have an open discussion going right now of whether we have a crazy president or not, or whether he's only pretending to be crazy, and whether that makes a difference, all of that. All of it leading up to the notion that they feared that this person might actually launch a surprise attack, okay? All that is similar. And now, what no one who's commented on this crisis, I take it you've studied it, the Able Archer and so forth, nobody comments on the fact that Andropov's readiness to respond to that was to preempt the attack, to move first. Go second first. Don't wait for the first one to go. Don't do like Barbarossa in World War II, where Hitler's armies captured millions and millions of Russians with a surprise attack. No, go first in a nuclear era. But that's insane. That's insane. Go first. The world ends when you go first. When did we learn that? 1983. That's the year of Abel Archer. In that year, Carl Sagan and the others came out with the news for the first time that the smoke from burning cities would be lofted into the stratosphere by firestorms. And here we were asking whether history repeats itself. In World War II, we were only able to get firestorms going three times mainly, but Hamburg, Dresden, and Tokyo. And a firestorm is a very special kind of a fire. You have to have simultaneous fires over a widespread area, which create updrafts from low pressure zones, then in the heated air rises, and bring in winds either in a rolling conflagration across, if there's a ground wind, or from all sides, creating temperatures now that are enormously high, 1500 degrees Fahrenheit. Temperatures you don't get under any other conditions except a nuclear weapon. Hiroshima created a firestorm, but nothing between Tokyo on March 9th and 10th and Hiroshima on August 6th created a firestorm. That's why they only killed 900,000 people, of whom 100,000 were on one night, because that was the firestorm. Now, what they discovered was, in 1983, the smoke from the burning city will be lofted by the firestorm, the force of these updrafts, into the stratosphere where it doesn't rain out. And it goes around the globe very quickly, obstructing sunlight for what we now know is more than a decade. Perhaps 70% of sunlight would be obstructed. This is assuming many cities, hundreds of cities being hit simultaneously, which would happen in our plans or Russian plans. Okay. The harvests would all be destroyed. Very little vegetation left, and nearly everyone would starve on Earth. Nuclear winter, not only a matter of the lakes freezing and the rivers freezing and terrible cold and drought, whatnot, but the death of the harvest would mean that the world food supplies of about 60 days. That's what's being threatened now by any initiation of nuclear war. Right now in North Korea, nuclear winter is not at stake. Of nine nuclear states, only one cannot blot out enough sunlight to starve at least 2 billion people. The Indians and Pakistanis can do that. The others can do more. North Korea, whether it has 20 or 30 or 60 weapons, can't cause nuclear winter. And they don't have enough cities there for us to loft that much smoke. But what would be involved is the death of several million people, more in one day or a week than has ever been seen in the history of the world. See, the biggest, number one, is Tokyo, 100,000, 80 to 120,000. This would be several million within a day or a week. So bigger than ever, but not nuclear winter. Not a good idea for North Korea. If North Korea thinks it's a good idea to start a war with the United States, wrong. On the other hand, if he has made provision to assure nuclear response to his being killed, Kim Jong-un, that's like every other ruler pretty much on this. You know, Hitler was willing to see Germany burned to the ground if he was going to get killed. I would say that ideas of decapitating Kim Jong-un are as reckless and murderous and, you know, as they could be. So we are building now another $1 trillion, perhaps $1.6 trillion, in allowing for inflation in the next 30 years, for weapons to do exactly this, to preempt an attack with this effect, right? So I'm saying that it's a craziness altogether. And in answer to your question, does history repeat itself? It hardly changes. It just goes on. Okay.
You are listening to an archival program with Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Paper fame. He's answering questions about his 2017 book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner.
Dan, I have a one-sentence question about the increasing automation of military operations and warfare. By the way, Peter Lumsdaine from the Ground Zero Jeep Action in Nevada back in the 80s on the Vandenberg MX campaign. So my question is, how do you think that the rapidly accelerating rise of corporate military robotics and artificial intelligence affects the challenges and resistance strategies for the human race in this century?
There is talk now of automating drone warfare almost entirely, you know, under automatic intelligence. Under Obama, the rules of engagement were raised for the drones at one point, and I think it was under Petraeus in particular in Afghanistan, to allow drones to attack anyone who fitted certain profiles of movement or of communications in various things. They didn't have to be any intelligence specifying them. They didn't have to be carrying special weapons or uniforms or anything else. But if they acted in a certain way, if they communicated in a certain way, hellfire missiles come down and hit wedding party after wedding party after wedding party and funeral parties. And then when people come out to the funerals of the people been kidding before, they get hit too, because they're a convocation of vehicles in the desert. What are they doing all together like that anyway? So this is horrible, but that's what happens. Well, you can automate that pretty easily. You know, if you have a set of criteria for launching the criterion, that's all it takes. In fact, at one point they said any male between, 14 and 40, something like that, is to be enemy combatants. Well, a computer can figure that one out. So you can automate that. In the book, I quote, going back now into the 50s, General Cooter, who was had various jobs, but at one point he was head of North American Air Defense Command, at other times Pacific Air Command, was saying to Herb York, I think at that time he was still director of Livermore Lab, later under Kennedy was research and engineering. So he tells that they were just starting on ABM work then. He said, anti-ballistic missile, and he said, you know, the timing is so fast there, the missiles are coming over, you can't wait for human decision. You know, you've got to automate this link and so forth. And Herb York was sort of going along with this up to a point. And then he said, of course, eventually we get it to the point where it's entirely computerized. And York says, you know, they'll recognize it, they'll go against it. Okay, so Cooter says, but eventually we'll get it so it's totally automated. And York says, oh no, we're never going to do that. And he reports, Cooter looked at him and said, well, we might as well surrender right now then. And so the answer then on AI and artificial intelligence, I believe, is there are many people who do not shrink from the idea of a Terminator-type warfare, you know, world in which the computers are waging war with us underneath. Yes, this does have to change. Since I've mentioned York, I want to mention one other thing. There are two major nuclear design labs, both of them campuses of the University of California. All of our nuclear weapons, from the atom bomb, first ones, Fat Man, Little Man, to the neutron bomb, to everything else, have all been designed at an American university. One university, the University of California. But anyway, York went back to Livermore and said, I've asked myself how many weapons it takes to deter someone rational enough to be deterred. So what would you say? Any candidates here?
I'm hearing one.
One? Well, that's what York said. One. He said one, but maybe you'd say you needed a few more, you know, in case they thought they could get the one, or one city they might be willing to sacrifice, something like that. Maybe 10. And then he went at it from another point of view. He said, what's the largest amount of destruction you would want one man, one person, one woman, to be able to inflict in a brief period of time? Is there some ceiling on that, or is there a too much? And he said, how about the total casualties of World War II, 60 million? Maybe the ability to kill 60 million people in a week or so should be the limit for what somebody can control. He says, well, that would take about 100 weapons, 100 kiloton weapons. He said, you could calculate, it might get up to 200, but not, probably not. It would be 100 or less. So he said the number needed to deter nuclear attack, which, by the way, Judith, is where I started. You know, how do we deter this attack? The number needed would be, quote, 1 to 10 to 100, but closer to 1 than 100. He says, okay. That would mean, by the way, 49. If North Korea has 60, which they probably don't, it's probably less, that's more than you could justify on this ground. Every other nuclear weapon state has many more than that. When Eisenhower came into office in 1953, we had 1,000 fission weapons, the type that destroyed Nagasaki, only most of them more powerful by that time than Nagasaki. But fission weapons, 1,000 that Truman left. When Eisenhower left office, we had 23,000, mostly thermonuclear weapons. The earlier thermonuclear weapons used Nagasaki weapons, need Nagasaki weapons as their detonator, as their percussion cap, as their fuse, you might say. The earliest of our H-bombs, it's easier to make a big one than a small one, actually, were 1,000 times more powerful than the Nagasaki. So we had 23,000 of those. Eventually, in 1967, under Johnson, see, I was in Vietnam in 67. In 67, we had 37,000 nuclear weapons. The Russians had close to 40,000 at that point, too. At the height, there was a total in the world of about 67,000 nuclear weapons. Come back to Herb York's point, 1 to 10 to 100 and closer to 1 than 100. Is it desirable to keep North Korea from getting an H-bomb and an ICBM? Yes. It was also desirable that Pakistan not get them and that India not get them, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, all of the others, in effect. Would that be the end of the world? Or is there any reason to believe, by the way, that North Korea would use those weapons against the U.S. out of the blue, unprovoked? Actually, no reason. Is it impossible? No, I wouldn't say it was impossible. He could have a false alarm. He could go crazy, something like that. It's definitely desirable he not have them. Are there ways of keeping him from getting them other than attacking? Probably yes, according to the people who know North Korea best. You'd have to have a peace treaty with North Korea. We don't have one since the Korean War. Lower or drop the sanctions. You'd have to stop exercising assassination and invasion. That doesn't seem impossible demands somehow. Well, that means we give up regime change. How can you give up regime change just because they're another country and aren't, you know, not a state of the United States? Well, since Iraq, we've talked about regime change, which is the definition of empire. A country that believes that it has the right and the power and the readiness and the intention to determine who rules another country. And we are, in fact, a covert empire, in my opinion. Covert in the sense of plausible denial, meaning the fact that we are an empire, that we have this determination to decide who runs this country and that country, is covert. We deny it plausibly. Why plausibly? Well, our people are educated to think, well, that's not us. That's not who we are. Actually, it is who we are, but we deny that. It's, He said, and moreover, the means are covert. Assassination, bribery, paramilitary, coups, and whatnot. So it's a denied empire, pretty much. If we gave that up, we would have a good chance of keeping North Korea from not moving ahead with ICBMs. That would be good. The military alternative is the almost certain death of several million people, mostly over there, our allies, mostly South Korea and Japan. I would say the current situation calls for the highest degree of one can imagine. I can't imagine what would be too much non-violently and truthfully to do, to convey to Congress, but above all to the executive branch, there must not be an attack on North Korea. That should be heard in letters to the editor, be heard in town hall meetings like this. Thank you for raising the question. I apologize for not raising it earlier. But I would put it the highest priority, avoiding a war with North Korea. And keep in touch with that in a way you couldn't do years ago. But now it's possible on the internet to find out a tremendous amount is leaking out, to be sure, to the rage of Trump. I can certainly say, by the way, that if someone in the administration, there must be hundreds of people, thousands of people, who have access to estimates in the administration that officially tell that not all the casualties would be over there, and that the casualties over there are absolutely intolerable. That's not the word that would be used officially. They would just say millions. By the way, it's not only that the effects of this war would not only be measured in casualties, in my opinion. And let me take 1 minute on that, because I believe we are in a crisis right now, not unlike the Cuban Missile Crisis or the 83 crisis, except in scale. We're not looking at the end of the world, but beyond the casualties, if there is an attack on this country in retaliation, which I would think is not certain, but highly likely, democracy is pretty much over in this country, I think.
Daniel Ellsberg, recorded by Mike McCormick at Seattle Town Hall on January 9, 2018. Ellsberg was on stage to discuss his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. In 1961, he consulted for the Department of Defense and the White House and drafted Secretary Robert McNamara's plans for nuclear war. You heard a TUC Radio archive edition of Daniel Ellsberg's Doomsday Machine. The full talk is over an hour long, and you can watch it for free online at Mike McCormick's Talking Stick TV. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.